By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the battle is now starting to change very quickly, especially for the soldiers within the ranks of the Union Army. Now keep in mind, by 12 o'clock, a good portion of the Union Army believes that they are on the verge of victory. And as I said earlier, yes, by 12 noon, things are going pretty well for the Union Army. But now as the battle starts to shift onto Henry Hill, they now begin to see that initial victory grind to a halt. In fact, now the victory is starting to slip very quickly through their very fingers. Two problems will face the Union Army in their fight here atop Henry Hill, one of which you already know about, and that is going to be the Confederate positions here atop the hill, those positions right here along the front edge of the woods. Now in 1861, the wood line will actually be back several more yards, but also the hill would not be as densely forested as you see here today. It would be smaller pockets or stands of trees dotting the landscape here atop Henry Hill. Now, in addition to the Confederates being up here in position, and probably the larger of the two problems that will face the Union Army, it will be their commanding general, General Irvin McDowell. Now, when McDowell begins launching his attack onto Henry Hill in terms of his infantry or foot soldiers, instead of sending up the bulk of his force at one time, say 10,000 men, to deliver that crushing blow to the Confederates, he will send his regiments into this fight two and three at a time. It's a very piecemeal attack. It's a very uncoordinated attack that for the most part just plays right into the hands of the Confederate soldiers up here. It will make it twice as hard for the Union Army to gain and then hold any type of ground here atop Henry Hill whatsoever. Shortly after 3 o'clock though, Captain Griffin, who I mentioned earlier with the two guns, he wheels into a very strong position just off to the left of the Confederates, just here to my left, just here to your right. Two guns that you see there today mark the approximate position he would have held. What Griffin is hoping to accomplish from the position there is the creation of what is known as an enfilade fire, or a type of fire that would have the ability to fire down the length of the opposing line, or in this case, the Confederate positions along the front edge of the woods, but also this position concealed down beyond the crest of the hill. It's a very destructive type of fire. Griffin realizes if he can open it up and then maintain it, he is going to have a very good chance of dislodging the Confederates from their strong position here on the hill, thereby allowing the Union Army a much easier advance onto the front edge of the field, quite possibly giving them the springboard that they are looking for to wrap up that early morning's victory. Within 5 minutes, though, of Captain Griffin arriving at his second position here on the hill, he maybe fires off two shots at the Confederate line before he and his men would notice a line of infantry advance out of the woods here in front of you. They will maneuver over a low fence line and into the open field. Now quickly, Griffin assumes that those troops must be Confederate. He will now order his gunners to pick the tails of the guns up. They will pivot the guns around to face that infantry. Griffin now prepares to give the order to open fire. However, before he can issue that order, up rode his commanding officer, Major William Berry. Berry rides up to Griffin and demands, "What are you doing? Don't fire there, Captain. These are the men I've sent up in support of your guns." Well, Griffin argues back, "No, those men are Confederate. As certain as the world, they are Confederate." Well, it really doesn't matter what Griffin says because he is arguing with a superior officer. In fact, Major Berry not only commands all of the Union artillery in this battle, but this is also an officer who 15, 20 minutes earlier had ordered up several regiments of infantry with the task of protecting the guns under Captain Griffin, but also the guns under Captain Ricketts, already seeing action here atop Henry Hill. And now as the smoke and confusion of this battle began to settle across the fields of the Henry Farm, it would probably be impossible to see, you know, 75, 100 yards distance. But combined with that, you have over 250 different styles of uniforms being worn out here on this hill. It makes it virtually impossible to distinguish friend from foe. But for Major Berry, he is adamant that the unit that cleared the wood line here in front of you was a regiment of New York infantry that he had ordered up just minutes earlier. Griffin now springs to his men and tells his men to hold their fire. In fact, he will actually redirect the guns to their previous position. Unfortunately, though, for Griffin and his gunners, the troops that broke the wood line here in front of you were indeed Confederate, quite possibly soldiers of the 33rd Virginia Infantry. Whoever they are, they're allowed to advance within about 75 yards of Griffin's guns. They will lower their muskets, and they will fire one volley. And as Captain Griffin would later remark, "That was the last of us." In the exchange of fire, Griffin would lose a number of his men, but most importantly, he would lose the vast majority of his horses, meaning that when he retreats off of Henry Hill, he had to leave his two guns behind. This will now allow the Confederates to charge forward. They would capture the guns and, in effect, create the turning point of this battle. It is the first Confederate success of the entire day. However, even with the Confederate capture of Griffin's guns, it is not going to be enough of an event to really shift the momentum of this battle, at least here atop Henry Hill, to one side or the other. For the better part of an hour, between about 3:15 up until about 4:30 in the afternoon, the battle just rages indecisively across the fields of the Henry Farm. And it will be during this seesaw battle for possession of the hill that Ricketts' guns, but also Griffin's guns, would change hands several times between the Union and Confederate armies. But while the focus of attention, while this battle on Henry Hill more or less just hangs in the balance, the Confederates are still becoming stronger and stronger throughout the afternoon. They're shifting up more men from downstream, but also the last of the troops to come in by rail to Manassas Junction, they're now arriving up on the battlefield, so that by 4:30, the Confederate line is now strong enough that the Confederates will launch a counterattack that by 5 o'clock began to push the Union Army back beyond Bull Run in the direction of Centerville, Virginia. In fact, by 5 o'clock, orders were certainly circulating throughout the entire Union Army to withdraw beyond Bull Run, back into Centerville, Virginia, and then onto the roads leading back to Washington, D.C. And for the most part, the Union Army, when they retreat off of the battlefield itself, they will do so in a very orderly manner. It is orderly until they reach a place called Cub Run. Cub Run is about 3 miles east of us. Its size is pretty much relative to Bull Run. It's only maybe a couple of yards wide, maybe a foot and a half deep with water at most times of the year. To cross Cub Run, though, the Union Army is using a one-lane bridge, and unfortunately for them, there's an overturned supply wagon blocking it. So now a good portion of the Army, the Union Army, is backing up in the direction of the battlefield. Confederates, meanwhile, are now maneuvering some of their artillery into positions that they can now fire at the retreating Union soldiers. And once these shells began to explode in and around those crowded troops on the roadway, a number of the men began to panic, and like a wildfire, that panic quickly spreads throughout the entire Union Army. One soldier likened it to a hurricane of wind. He said it was a scene of mass chaos, that there were soldiers running in every conceivable direction, that there were horses without riders, that there were wagons without drivers, flipping end over end. Now, whereas it took the Union Army, for the most part, the 2 full days to advance from Washington to Centerville, it will take the bulk of that same army just under 19 hours to do the return trip home. The Confederates, meanwhile, they did not pursue the Union Army because in their victory, the Confederates were just as disorganized and as exhausted as the Union Army was in defeat. But for the Confederates, they are satisfied with what they've accomplished here. Namely, they've protected the Manassas Junction, but also they had literally sent the Union Army running for its life back towards Washington, D.C. In the wake of this battle, though, this first major battle of the war, both sides quickly realized that this would not be the short, and it would definitely not be the relatively bloodless affair that everyone had first spoke of. By battle's end, some 3,500 soldiers would be killed, wounded, or missing. Of that number, 900 will actually die on or near the battlefield itself. By the time the war is brought to an end, though, 4 years later, in the spring of 1865, that number of 900 will increase to over 625,000 dead. There's more American lives lost than the First World War, the Second World War, and the Korean War combined together. It will not be until about 8 years into the war in Vietnam that we actually surpass the numbers lost here in just 4 years of fighting of the American Civil War. 21st of July, 1861, not only marks a beginning of the major land battles that are going to be contested, but more so, it marks an end of innocence for the United States of America, because it is here on the fields that we have walked a bit this morning that the naive misconceptions the United States had about the approaching war were obliterated forever. By the time the armies returned here just over a year later in August of 1862 to fight the Second Battle of Manassas, it is no longer with this idea of a short, glorious war or that these soldiers would die a heroic death. These soldiers now realize that the next battle they enter would be one of great tragedy, but also one with scenes of unspeakable horror. If you have some additional time here in the park today, just a couple of quick suggestions for you to continue your tour. We do have a 1 mile self-guided trail here atop Henry Hill that'll give you some more insight into the battle here in 1861. The trail begins under the cedar tree where we started our tour. Just use the marker that's in the field there. It'll give you an overview map. Basically, just take you down Captain Ricketts' position over to the Henry House. The grave of Mrs. Henry is located out on the side of the house opposite of us. From there, you would continue to the far side of the field, to the side of the James Robinson home, then work your way right back here along the Confederate line to Griffin's guns, finish up over here at the Visitor Center parking lot. From 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock this afternoon, the Stone House will be open for you to visit. The house served as a field hospital during both battles of Manassas. The house is located by taking a right-hand turn out of the driveway, and then the house is located right at the intersection of Route 29 and Route 234, just a half a mile north of us. Also, the park brochure which is available at the information desk. That'll give you a driving tour that will cover the second Battle of Manassas, which was fought here in the summer of 1862, just 13 months after this one was contested in the summer of 1861. But whatever decisions you make with your time today, I thank you for a bit of it already and hope that you make the best of any additional you have here in the park with us today. Thank you very much. Thank you.